KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and this year a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on the author of the book Terms of Service, Social Media and the Price of Constant Connection. The author is Jacob Silverman. And we are going to dig into this very sharp critique of social media and the impact of social media on our world today. We have really, since the launch of Hearsay Culture, focused on social media and really communication issues involving the internet from the very beginning. We have talked, one of my earliest guests was Richard Lanham, talking about the economics of attention and how attention was becoming so scarce as technology started to become truly pervasive. And this is going back to 2006, 2007. We've talked more recently to David Zweig, who's written about people who work in anonymity. We've talked to people on the contract side of social media and how contracts impact terms of service with people like Woody Hartsock from Cumberland School of Law, and on and on. In terms of service, Jacob is taking a broad look at what it means to have social media as an adult, or even a child, really, operating within our technological sphere. When you go to the dust jacket of the book, the first endorsement of the book is from Gary Steingart, who is someone who has written extensively, and many Hearsay Culture listeners, I'm sure, are very familiar with his literature, on these somewhat dystopian views and perspectives on modern society. And particularly, he's focused heavily in books like Super Sad True Love Story on how people interact at a very personal level within, you know, a futuristic world, but certainly a world that reflects perhaps where we are today. And so the book focuses broadly on social media, but really I think takes a closer look at what we might think of as network effects and what networks mean in the context of how we communicate today. Several years ago I had Manuel Castells on talking about power and networks, and we've talked about network theory on the show quite a bit, but here we're going to kind of bring all of these ideas together in the context of this, like I said, very wide-ranging and very critical book involving these issues. So Terms of Service, which was published by HarperCollins, is a book written for a broad audience. So it's not written, I interview many authors who focus in academic writing. This is a book written for a broader audience, and yet I think there's a lot that it can teach both scholars as well as neophytes in this area. By way of background, Jacob's work has been published in the New York Times, the LA Times, Slate, The Atlantic, and New Republic. He was, in 2008, the Virginia Quarterly Review recognized him as one of the top literary critics under 30. I should have mentioned this right up front, he has been a three-time Jeopardy champion, so there really shouldn't be any question today that should really be all that difficult. However, I may ask Jacob to put himself in an isolation chamber if I want to share anything as an aside with you. He's on the board of Deep Vellum, a publisher of international literature, and he is joining us via Skype from San Francisco. We're recording on May 20th, 2015. Jacob, thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thanks for having me and for that great introduction.
Jacob, let me dive right in with the question that Hearsay Culture listeners know I ask virtually everyone. Tell us more about your background and why you wrote this book.
Sure. Well, I've been a freelance journalist of one form or another for about 7 years now. And I was often writing about culture and doing things like book reviewing and writing cultural criticism. But I always sort of had one eye towards politics and larger issues that I thought couldn't really be always worked out in the realm of cultural criticism. And when I started paying more attention to tech a few years ago, I realized that writing about tech, if you got away from sort of the kind of gadget-driven and driven journalism that defines a lot of tech writing, or the stuff about who's up and who's down at various companies, you could use technology to really tackle lots of issues of culture, social life, politics, and economics. And that really became appealing to me. And of course, during that time, there's also this great shift going on in how people communicate with the rise of social media. And so in some ways, it just seemed to come together in that way. I started writing kind of individual pieces about social media and mourning, mourning the dead, that is, or social media and kind of self-promotional culture, and how we often feel induced to act on social media in a kind of self-promotional manner. And so after sort of starting that down that road, I decided that maybe there was actually a book here and that I could kind of produce a broader critique that incorporate a lot of my ideas.
So when we think about this concept of social media, and I'm going to start off right here, and this is an academic question, but I believe strongly in defining our terms. What do you mean by social media, or how do you define it?
Right. It's a worthwhile question because sometimes we think we know, but then you start actually taking a closer look, and it can be a little harder to narrow down. I mean, I think that social media in many respects now refers to the kind of the big platform owners of the internet, Google, Facebook, Twitter, companies like that. But it's also, I think, a set of features and practices. It means living in public in one sense or another. It usually means that you're broadcasting to some large network or public audience. It means that lots of people are talking at once, that probably nothing is ever deleted. And usually these networks or platforms are advertising driven and monetized based on data collection. So to me, it really comes down to more of these sets of kind of practices and digital environments and kind of techniques of communicating rather than any single form of media or any single company.
So if we think about it that broadly, that it's helpful to go right back to your title, Terms of Service. Now, I teach contracts, and so I got very excited without knowing anything more about, oh, Terms of Service, we're going to talk about contracts. In a sense, we are talking about these relationships, but of course, you're not focusing on written documents, the kind of thing that I might test my 1Ls on. What do you mean by Terms of Service? Is it a play on words, or is there more to it?
Yeah, I'm sorry to disappoint you. The book, actually, despite the title, doesn't talk about terms of service agreements very much, but it is kind of a play on words. And, of course, we are bound by these sort of contractual agreements that we either implicitly agree to or we check the box. But I did want to use it more as a pun and kind of to get as a provocation and to get people thinking. And one of my larger points is that when we accept the terms of these platforms and when we become members of them or users of them, we really have very little control over that relationship. It's very much dictated by the corporation. And then I think also I later in the book, I get into issues of labor, of are the users of social media platforms actually kind of unpaid laborers, and where are we the drivers of value? So in that way, I think that terms of also reflects this idea that this broad mass of users are the people kind of in service to these platforms who are contributing value to them.
So last introductory question, and you started alluding to your broader themes, and I want to ask you if there is a defining thesis in the book and what it is in a moment. When you think about constant connection, of course, connection can be defined differently. You could think about connection from a technological perspective in terms of literally the network. You could think about connection from a social perspective, from a communicative perspective, from a human perspective. What do you mean? Is there a definition of constant connection that you think of or thought of as you wrote this book?
Sure. I think there are a couple important kinds of connection. I mean, the main one and the one that really brings us into these environments, I think, is the promise of connecting with other people, whether people we know or strangers or people we might want to know or people we find interesting. But connection also means in a more, perhaps a more literal sense of being connected to electronic networks and systems and having and constantly producing data that's often collected by third parties. So I think there's sort of the social aspect of connection, which is certainly a great draw, but also the fact of being constantly connected and simply being online all the time in one form or another.
We're chatting with Jacob Silverman, author of the book Terms of Service, Social Media and the Price of Constant Connection on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. All right, so this is the most academic question I'm going to ask you, Jacob. I have to do it. I particularly like people that asking this question of people that are not academics, just to really fulfill the stereotype. What is, if there is one, a broad thesis that you might say comes out of your book?
Well, I think we can start with the subtitle, which is The Price of Constant Connection. And one of my big thesis might be that the price of constant connection is really constant surveillance and the erosion of privacy and giving oneself over to these platforms and surrendering potentially a lot of autonomy and even some personal rights. And what I try to find a balance in the book is to say that, look, a lot of these services and platforms and modes of communicating are very interesting and very compelling and useful, but we've given up a lot in return, and also it doesn't necessarily have to be this way.
So let me deal with this question up front, which you know is I don't want to characterize what I was about to. I'm just going to ask the question. You address several times in the book this Luddite critique of technology, which I think has become a shorthand at this point to label anyone who expresses skepticism about the ability of information technology to make broad positive transformations in society. I am not characterizing your book, but no doubt some might view your book as a, quote, Luddite critique of social media for reasons that we can talk about as we go through some of that analysis. But I want to ask you up front, what's your reaction to that kind of labeling, and what's your reaction broadly to the use of this term in the way that I've described it? Or do you even agree with that characterization of how the term is used?
Oh, I agree with you that that's how it's used. And it is something that's kind of raised, or that I've seen people say in relation to my book. If not using the term Luddite, then something that's similarly negative, I suppose. I try to use terms like digital skeptic, but I also don't mind the term Luddite so much, because I mentioned this briefly in the beginning of the book, but the Luddite movement was originally it was a reaction against technologies of automation, but it was also about labor and about securing the rights of workers against technologies that were imposed on them by management. So in that way, I think, there might be room for rehabilitating the term Luddite and kind of taking a larger view of what it really means. But it's all kind of a challenge, because people sort of want to put you in one binary category, I think, where you're either positive or negative, a Luddite or an enthusiast or a skeptic or a techno-utopian. And it's understandable why those categories are pretty convenient and kind of handy to draw on. I don't mind aligning myself more with the Luddite or skeptic crowd if we're using those binaries, but I also try to say to people, especially in conversations or talks that I do, that I'm no Puritan or fundamentalist when it comes to this stuff. The reason why I write about it in part is because I use these products and services a lot. Some I've decided not to use anymore, but I'm certainly immersed in this world and interested in it and find some use and value in it. But I'm also become, I think, pretty attuned to what I see as the inequities and the problems.
So you alluded to it in your answer, and I think it's worth exploring a little bit, Jacob, which is this parallel to labor uses of the term. And I'll preface this question by saying that I've always been interested in seeing how labor concepts of information asymmetries and power, and as you used it, imposition, impacts how we understand technology. So perhaps I'll ask you to expand on that part of your critique of not only the word Luddite, but really of social media as you've defined it. How do you view the imposition or the power relationship to exist within the context of just random internet user interacting with social media?
Sure. Well, I think first of all, we have to acknowledge that the user is basically transparent to the platform owner. or to, and it might not just be the platform owner of Facebook or wherever else, but to add networks and data brokers and intelligence agencies and really anyone who is in a good position to collect information on users. So I do, you mentioned the term informational asymmetry. I do often think in that way that users are very much transparent to kind of the corporate and governmental powers in this world, and that they in turn are rather opaque to us. So if you're conscious of this great gap in knowledge, it's easy to feel very disempowered in this environment, that social media is perhaps not as democratizing or empowering as we're often told it is, but rather that we're kind of surrounded by people watching us and assessing us and sorting us into categories, but we don't always know why or what the methodology is or where information that about us might turn up at a later date. So it's really this kind of murky world in my view. And I hear some scholars talk about that we need to make companies more transparent, or they also say that we need to make them more visible, or that we need to make kind of the algorithmic world more legible, something that we can see and talk about and understand how it works. And that's really how I see these sort of power relationships occurring.
So I realize this now. Let me ask you two more terms before we dig in a little bit. And it's a phrase which I think is worth exploring here in light of the critique that you've offered. What is sentiment analysis?
Well, from my understanding, it's really the studying through automatic systems generally of how people are feeling, their emotions and attitudes. And on social media, we see it with intelligence agencies trying to find out whether people are being radicalized by analyzing the utterances of large populations. But it's also, of course, very important for marketers who are studying large populations as well for their reactions to different products or advertising campaigns. Politicians do it, and hedge funds as well. But to me, it's really this process of language analysis that, from my understanding, is really hit or miss at this point, to try to produce maps, if you will, of people's emotions and attitudes.
And so one more there, and this is heavy-duty definitions here, but I think it's helpful. Data valence, which, you know, we spent a lot of time on this show talking about surveillance. What is data valence?
Data valence is really just surveillance through the collection of data, but it's also through the collection of data that's kind of formed or created as exhaust in this digitized world. It's not my term, but I've seen it used in a few other places, a lot of it's very much automatic and kind of done as a course of doing business, especially since data is kind of the commodity and sort of fuel for these systems. So I just look at data valence as surveillance done through the collection and monitoring of user data.
And so from that perspective, Jacob, if you're going to identify a paradigmatic example of where we might see your thesis play out, is there an example of it? And there's multiple examples that you use in the book, but is there one that you think of when you think about how to crystallize that data valence risk in the context of social media?
I think one very basic example is the ways in which our posts and utterances can be used on Google Plus, which we have to admit is dying, but also on Facebook, which is that we know that things that we say on Facebook may be later turned into ads. So if we say something, and this also incorporates sentiment analysis perhaps, so if we say something in praise of a product or a company, it might later be turned into an ad that's shown to our friends. Now, that's a more visible manifestation, I think, because when someone sees that, they know, okay, the data I produced, my posts were repackaged by this system as an ad. But I think there are also many more obscure ways, and that's what really concerns me most, is when We know that we're producing data and information about ourselves, some of it perhaps very revealing, but we don't always know where it might be going or who it might be sold to.
So when you think about an entity like Google and other social media platforms, throughout the book, you mention a number of them. And you mentioned, for example, the website Clout, K-L-O-U-T, which some listeners may be familiar with, but which, you know, formed, I think, as its reason for being. It was designed to somehow aggregate mentions and sites to and hyperlinks to you, an individual or an entity, to determine how much influence you have out there. Clout, at the same time, at least in my, and this is pure anecdata, but in my estimation, I've rarely met anyone who took it seriously. In fact, I've generally seen it more as a punchline. And I'm curious whether there is a way to differentiate, or whether we should differentiate, between the social media entities that are having the impacts that you suggest, and those that may not be by virtue of their success. In other words, are there social media entities, in your view, that don't have or share this critique that you offer in the book?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think there are that many. We've seen some, like Elo, that promise not to collect user data, and or at least not to collect user data in the service of advertising. And the brief sort of flurry of interest that surrounded it last summer, I thought was pretty heartening, at least showed some desire. And it made me also think that if something like app.net, which operated based on similar principles, were introduced a few years later, perhaps there would have been more of a hunger for it. But I think most of these platforms do operate on the same principles, simply because of the primacy of data-driven advertising. But I also think that we've been given a very narrow picture of what social media can be. One thing that we often take for granted is the use of like buttons or favorite buttons or hearts or whatever they might be, and also the fact that there are metrics attached to pretty much every post or social media broadcast. And I would be really curious to see what a social network looked like that didn't have those things, that perhaps didn't tell you how many people had liked or favorited a post, that didn't tell you on Twitter now you can see the analytics for pretty much any tweet, which I think really is just pushing users to act more like advertisers or sort of business users. To go back to the Clout example, I do agree that many people see Clout as a punchline, and it's certainly kind of fallen out of public view in a way. On the other hand, it was bought for, I think, $200 million by another company not that long ago. So someone at least saw some value in it. But I do talk to some people in marketing who occasionally tell me that they use Clout, or at least try to take advantage of it for rewards. But even the fact that Clout is kind of a punchline, I think that the fact that it did have a big presence in sort of the early years of social media, I think that kind of is important, because it reflects these sorts of attitudes and the logic at work behind social media, which is about quantification, about forming metrics about one's own social capital, and rising in these hierarchies that are often created by the platforms themselves. So in that way, I think Clout, while it's certainly easy to make fun of and deserving of a lot of that, I do think it very much reflects the kind of methods and logic that is built into these platforms.
You know, and you mentioned it a minute ago, and I want to come back to it, which is that I think you're referring to the Facebook study that received widespread criticism about a year ago. Am I correct about that, Jacob?
Yeah,
so I want to ask you about that. James Grimmelman was on the show talking about his writing in that space, and one of the things that James focused on, I want to ask your opinion on it, with regard to social media broadly, among the concerns that James had about the study was the fact that it was done in this secretive manner, and at the same time Facebook took the position that their terms of service, recognizing that's not your focus here, explicitly but their terms of service authorized them to do what they had done. James's critique was the notice basically didn't exist. How much of your concern about social media is driven only by the fact that social media companies have operated in this less than forthright manner? Is that central to your concern, or is that kind of a secondary problem to the larger issues that you're trying to address?
Well, I do think it is a big problem. I think, though, that it's a problem that's likely to become that might be secondary in some ways to what I write about in the book, but I think it's likely to become more important as these platforms become more central to the sorting and filtering of information. When I started writing the book about 2 years ago, many people thought that Facebook was somehow on the decline. I didn't fully believe that because they still had over 1 billion users. But and they were buying up companies. I think they bought WhatsApp while I was writing the book, but they bought Instagram, and they obviously have a big war chest, and they had network effects on their side with all these users. But now, but at the time, people were sort of thinking that, oh, young people don't like Facebook anymore. It's all about Snapchat and other messaging apps, and that's sort of it. But what's almost surprised me in a way is that, and I think surprised some people, is that we're seeing a rise of a new generation of big platforms and monopolies like Facebook and Google, who are really in the business of filtering information for a lot of people, and also, as we now know, experimenting on them in ways that are often mysterious, if not outright secret. And increasingly, we also see these big platforms buying up competitors and kind of centralization of the internet. I know John Herman, who writes for The All, AWL, he writes about this a bit, how the internet, which was once so thought of as so highly distributed, is now kind of being re-centralized under these big corporate owners. And you see that even with Facebook now hosting news media organizations' content directly. So I think it's a definite concern and likely to be a bigger one, because as long as we know that these companies can influence us in certain ways, that they are filtering a lot of information on our behalf, that they're deciding who's important to us, what kind of opportunities we should have, or at least that their automated systems are deciding this, I think it's a big concern that there's this kind of secrecy and that we don't really know when these experiments are happening or exactly how these algorithms work.
We're chatting with Jacob Silverman, author of the book Terms of Service, Social Media and the Price of Constant Connection, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope you continue to listen to the show. Sticking on this issue of data and the gathering of data, Jacob, I was curious about this. I came across this story literally last night regarding the sale or the dissolution of Radio Shack. Obviously, Radio Shack not being a social media platform, but here's the connection. One of the issues that the Federal Trade Commission is now going to have to weigh in on and is weighing in on is how the customer data that Radio Shack holds should be disposed of, because obviously it's a very valuable customer list with not just names, but of course purchasing histories that could allow someone to start targeting their advertising. Of course, the same issue will inevitably arise as social media platforms die off. And again, it may still be hard to imagine that Facebook will be gone one day, but it certainly could be, and other social media platforms, as we've alluded to, might be gone. What's your take on what we should, both from a policy perspective and really from a consumer perspective, be thinking about when entities that have this data ultimately are in the position to either want to sell it or have to sell it? Now, I'll put aside for the moment whatever limitations there might be on the sale through regulation or contract. But in a world where these entities have to make a choice, what should be the driving principles around that?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I've followed the Radio Shack story, a bit, and it's kind of a surprising turn. Perhaps some people didn't identify Radio Shack with having this kind of with this valuable asset that all these various companies, some in very different fields, would be interested in. I think the problem is that when people turn over personal data, whether kind of involuntarily or without their knowledge through their own activities online or through things like filling out forms when making a purchase or signing up for a new cell phone, they don't often anticipate where the data might go, and indeed they might have no way to anticipate where the data might go. So I certainly think that we should institute some measures to regulate this kind of sale, but we also start need to thinking about the fact that not all data is equal, that perhaps some types of data is more sensitive than others, that certain data should be deleted after a period of time or should sunset in some way, and that perhaps users should also be allowed to query companies and ask, what do you have on me, and please delete it. But I think, though, that still doesn't get at the full nature of the problem, because so many people will simply never know that this information about them is out there or that it's up for sale, and won't have either the time or education or resources to do anything about it. But on the other hand, that's kind of the virtue of regulation, isn't it? Which is that regulation takes these ethical impulses of ours and really tries to look out for everybody. So I don't know if we need some sort of regulator, perhaps under the FTC, devoted simply to these data issues and the commoditization of personal data. But it certainly seems like we're headed in a direction where there is that kind of need, especially as what makes the Radio Shack example interesting is it's very clear that data is this commodity, that in some ways it's unfortunate, and I've tried to argue against it becoming a commodity, but it has a dollar value that you can put on it, and it can be as simple as a list of people and their names and addresses and social security numbers. It doesn't have to be incredibly detailed profiles, though of course a social security number is a sensitive piece of information.
From an intellectual property law perspective, I'm not asking you this question, but it segues into my next question. A lot of this information would be a trade secret, in the sense that that Radio Shack gathered this information, and it has competitive value, because it has the potential to allow for increased marketing, and yet Radio Shack is going away. More broadly, with regard to the world of social media, it is my sense that while consumers may not say, oh, Radio Shack's data is a trade secret, right? A consumer could easily say, Google has information about me, and I wonder what Google can or cannot do with it. A longstanding critique of social media has been that social media has been able to play on general ignorance on the part of its customers and users, which you've alluded to. But as we're recording in May 2015, how sophisticated do you think users are today in terms of the concerns that you've raised in the book?
Well, I think we see research from Pew and other organizations that show people definitely have specific privacy concerns, or that a lot of people, especially in the wake of the Snowden revelations, have taken efforts to kind of lock down their digital profile, whether by trying to use VPNs or other software, or even simply going into the privacy settings of some of the products that they use. But I think for a lot of people, it still remains, these problems remain a kind of abstraction. It's hard to really know what the problem is, what they should exactly fear. And so there's a sense in which many people simply shrug their shoulders or kind of adopt a cynical resignation to the state of affairs. So I think we're definitely trending in the right direction of people becoming more informed, but I also find that education and kind of a more granular understanding of what's really going on here, and what rights companies have and what rights individual consumers have, is kind of lost on a lot of people, I think. But that's also, again, I think very understandable because the stuff is very complicated, even to some of the same people who work on these systems. I mean, if you just look at a single ad that's served up to you on a website, there are potentially, you know, a half dozen companies involved in presenting that ad, in, you know, crunching the data that's behind it, in targeting you specifically. So these are really complicated systems, and they're not necessarily easy for the average user to understand. And even when they do understand them, it's not always easy for them to know what the next step should be.
And much of what we're talking about here, and we haven't focused on it heavily, and now I'll ask you, is this concern about privacy, right? And users think they have certain idea or rights of privacy, which they may sign away in contract or simply give up by virtue of their activities. Much of your book talks about this price of constant connection as being giving up of control. But is that the same in your view as privacy harms or privacy invasions in the context of social media, or should we think about control and privacy as separate ideas?
Well, I think it's certainly possible to separate them. Pardon me. Let me just get some water here.
Sure.
But I've also tried to think about two different types of privacy, and perhaps some other people have kind of made this distinction, but I think of two different types of privacy that are related, but also in some ways run in parallel. So there's the basic type of privacy that we're more familiar with, which is what do people know about you, and how much control do you have over what people know about you, and to sort of determine that, to reveal yourself as you wish, and to be sort of the shaper of your own identity and public image. So on social media, that plays out with things like privacy settings or wanting to send private messages to people or limit a post to only a certain audience and not have it be public, or perhaps be able to join a group on Facebook. That's one of the examples I cite, is people were brought into Facebook groups, to different LGBT Facebook groups, and it was that notification appeared on their timeline, but some of those people weren't out to their families, and it created you know, a lot of tension or even trauma for some people. And I think that's a still important, but also in some ways traditional type of privacy. What do people, friends, family, and strangers know about us? But then there is this more data-driven element of privacy, which I think feeds into this idea of control, and which deserves in some ways a separate look. And in some ways, this doesn't even really involve people. We're just talking about automated or semi-automated systems of data collection and sorting and processing. But as personal data is being fed into more and more of these processes, it seems to become more important, because we know that various types of control can be, or influence can be, exerted over people by presenting them different opportunities or steering them in a certain direction, sometimes in a literal direction if you're giving them mapping directions. So I think we've done a pretty good job in sort of public discussion on the first type of privacy, even though, you know, people like Mark Zuckerberg claim that, you know, that individuals don't care as much about privacy. But the corollary with that is we perhaps haven't done as good a job at talking to people about this other type of privacy, about how there's the information about you, your personal self, but then there's also your data self, which kind of has this entire life of its own. And I'm happy to talk about it in terms of control or power or influence, but to me that's also a type of privacy.
We're chatting with Jacob Silverman, author of the book Terms of Service, Social Media and the Price of Constant Connection, on KZSU. I also have a cold. KZSU Stanford and Hearsay Culture. You know, before I turn to, you have an interesting critique in the book of technology and whether it's neutral or not, which I want to turn to in a few minutes, Jacob. But before we do that, I mentioned Richard Lanham earlier in my introduction, and his fascinating and you know, somewhat early work on the economics of attention. I've had Gary Small on the show in the past, who's talking about the physiological physiological limitations of a child and teenager's brain and their ability to make complex decisions, therefore leading to a lot of the harms that you're concerned about with regard to the use of social media by people that aren't not only not familiar with the risks but may not literally be able to comprehend them. Do you have an opinion on those issues? And my question really for you is this. Does social media have, and social media entities, do they have a responsibility to shield children, to shield others that lack capacity from the kinds of harms in terms of privacy and data valence and control? And of course, we haven't even talked about negative uses of information in areas like employment and more. What role should social media companies play in dealing with those kinds of problems?
Sure. Well, I'll start with the second part first. I think they do have some responsibility because increasingly they are in the business of bringing us opportunities and information that are really essential to our lives. I mean, I saw, I was reading about a study in which they found that women searching job sites are often shown lower paying jobs than males who have similar profiles are. And now if you take the example of young people, you could say that, well, say Facebook perhaps adds a college search feature to its platform. It might be some sort of feature that starts recommending schools that for high school students. Or you could see LinkedIn doing this. LinkedIn has actually encouraged high school and college students to join and to start networking at an early age. If suddenly one of these platforms becomes in the business of sort of trying to tell potential students which school might be best for them, or their profile kind of matches to people who apply to these five schools, well, then suddenly that's a potential ethical minefield, I think, simply because you are, while you might be steering students towards interesting or important opportunities, you might also be limiting them in unintended ways. So I think anytime you're in that business of filtering information and kind of shaping someone's world, there are definite responsibilities. But to get to the problem of attention and distraction, in my book, I do talk a bit about kind of the neurological effects of constant distraction. But I really don't go too much into that, partly because I think a lot of people have done a good job with that, and I'm not a neuroscientist, and I'm not very steeped in that literature. But I'm also more interested in sort of the experiential or phenomenological experience of this. What is it like to be on these platforms, to have this feeling of being distracted, even if it's not, you know, measured through brainwaves or anything like that? And I think we can see that these platforms are designed as sort of distraction and immersion machines. One comparison that I've seen made that I think is pretty powerful is this idea of the machine state of that people get into in front of slot machines, where people get very immersed and distracted from the world around them, and have this sense of time becoming sort of distended or losing track of time, and suddenly an hour has passed, and if you're on a slot machine, you might be down $50. If you're online, the experience is more like you end up spending a lot of time just almost numbly scrolling through a feed or refreshing or scrolling through someone's photos. Now, this isn't necessarily always a bad thing, and we have to account for some personal responsibility or control that we have, but there is no doubt, I think, that these platforms are designed to increase stickiness, to increase that kind of immersion, and when we go away from the platform or when perhaps the platform thinks our attention is lagging, there are all these alerts and notifications and people you may know, kind of reminders and things like that to bring us back. So whether they want to admit it or not, I think a lot of these platforms are in kind of the business of behavioral management, or at least in trying to induce certain behaviors in people. And when whether you're talking about adults or especially with young people, I think that's a potentially challenging position to be in, and one that deserves a lot of skepticism and criticism.
So, Jacob, we're at the point in the show which I call the unfair portion of the show, and that's where I started asking you questions where you don't have the adequate time you'd like to answer the question thoroughly, having sold the show to you as a show where you can answer questions thoroughly. So I change up the rules. But I guess I can do that because I'm the host.
So I
appreciate you working with me on that. part of this critique, and it's a really interesting one, I want to spend several minutes on it here, is the suggestion you make in the book that technology is not neutral. In other words, that technology encourages or allows for certain behaviors, and therefore the technology itself is not in a neutral position with regard to how people use it. Now, as you know, that's a very controversial concept within technology, because as you know, and coming at this from a perspective that I do, having worked in intellectual property policy arena for quite a while, many in the entertainment and content industry have suggested in the past that the internet is very much sided towards piracy or copyright infringement, and therefore technology that is the internet is not neutral. What's your take on that critique, and what do you think of neutrality as a guiding principle to think about social media?
Well, I admit that I am very sympathetic to this argument that technology isn't neutral. I mean, to kind of butcher an Orwell phrase, some technologies might be more neutral than others. I mean, I would argue that a fork doesn't really have much kind of ethical character, or really, you know, if someone calls a fork a neutral technology, I'm not going to really bother to argue with them. But sociologists talk about affordances, or sort of what kind of behaviors does technology privilege or encourage in some ways. And I think that's really important to look at, that you could argue, sure, that the internet, the way it's designed, it affords piracy, it makes piracy easier. But I also say that technology isn't neutral, because technology isn't just sort of an abstraction or something that stands on its own. It's both the product of a lot of economic, social, and cultural and political conditions, and it also is embedded in that same kind of context, or perhaps in a different social and political context from which it was made. But you know, technology is always incorporating the environment in which it was created, and oftentimes the intentions or biases of its creators. And I think one way we see that now is in the design of algorithms. At least when we're allowed to get a better sense of how they work. We see, for example, I kind of lost my train of thought there, but I think that we see the ways in which kind of human intention and biases can be programmed into systems, so that algorithms aren't necessarily neutral. They're looking for specific criteria or privilege certain criteria. Even just take a look at the Facebook news feed, which has been tinkered with quite a bit over the years. For a while, Facebook was being flooded with really crummy content that people were sharing. Now, it may have reflected a certain desire of people to share that content, kind of silly listicles or viral media articles that were basically, you know, urban legends, kind of Snopes type stuff that wasn't really true at all, and image macros and other stuff that we now tend to think of as kind of junk media. One reason why a lot of this stuff was appearing on Facebook was because the newsfeed algorithm was programmed in a certain way to promote that kind of content. Now, it might not necessarily have an ethical character, but it certainly doesn't strike me as neutral or kind of indifferent to what's going on. Instead, you could say that now you have Facebook talking about, well, we want to promote more quality content, and we want Facebook to be a place where people can talk about quality issues, where political issues get aired, because there's been a lot of criticism that certain political issues don't show up in the newsfeed algorithm, that you can go on Twitter and see people talking about the riots in Baltimore, but for some reason those kinds of posts don't seem to appear in the Facebook newsfeed. So when you're talking about those kind of different outcomes and the ways in which something like the newsfeed algorithm is constantly being tinkered with, I think you have to acknowledge that that technologies have different effects based on the environments in which they're used and based on how they're programmed, and that inherently makes them not neutral. It means that they have some control or influence over other people, and that they perhaps empower some individuals more than others.
So in the last few minutes here, Jacob, I will do a little pushback question here, just to probe a little more deeply on this issue of neutrality. You know, even if we grant that technologies enable certain behaviors that we may think are socially undesirable or maybe even illegal, ultimately, the issue comes down to what you do about those things. And so, you know, drawing back on this experience within the, you know, copyright and IP policy battles, oftentimes industry took the position that because, let's say, the internet or web hosts or websites are not neutral, we need to ban or make it illegal to use the technology to do certain things. And so I'm thinking about something like BitTorrent. Industry went after BitTorrent and other peer-to-peer technologies, saying the technologies themselves are not neutral, and therefore the technologies should be banned. I'm not suggesting that. You aren't suggesting something like that in the book, but I'm curious about your take on that line of reasoning. In other words, does neutrality or the lack of neutrality of technology give justification to banning behaviors or the technology itself? Again, emphasizing that that's not your argument in the book, but I'm curious about your take on that line of reasoning.
Right, and I do acknowledge that it's sort of an outgrowth of the kind of argument I was just making. I think I may agree with you in that you have a pretty difficult job ahead of you if you really want to ban technologies simply from a practical standpoint, especially digital technologies. I mean, if we're talking about something that's manufactured, it's a lot easier to outlaw than something that's just a computer program you download. And I also think it does potentially set a bad precedent where we have certain technologies being policed or declared illegal and verboten, and others are more readily allowed and accepted under the law. I think the solution might be instead to, we often hear about self-regulation, things like that. I don't think that's necessarily a solution, though. It's always great to have companies feeling kind of more ethically engaged and coming together to talk about the effects of their products and technologies. But perhaps it's a call more for regulation than anything else, because while we don't have to necessarily outlaw certain technologies, we can introduce ways to limit their use or to at least encourage more positive uses of them. And some of those might be through regulations or through, instituting fines or warnings for certain behaviors. But I pretty much agree that I don't think banning technologies outright is going to really get us anywhere. And there will always be this issue, I think, especially with something like BitTorrent, which is that in that case, you can say it can be used for good and bad. I mean, an old example is that you can use a bread knife to cut bread or to cut someone's throat. BitTorrent can be used to transmit files that are perfectly legal or useful and to break them up in ways that are very convenient, make for ease of use and transmission. But then, of course, it's also a pirate's dream. So I think also we're just going to continue to see this sort of war between competing technologies in some cases, though I think we've also seen over the last decade that that trying to lock down intellectual property, especially through technological means, limiting how music can be played and things like that on certain devices or how it can be shared is potentially a fool's errand as well. And specifically when we're talking about piracy, there are some arguments that, well, in certain arenas, piracy can encourage people's consumption of those products or kind of help promote the person themselves. But that's to go down an unnecessary tangent, perhaps. So I think the point is really that we can talk about the characteristics of certain technologies, the behaviors that they encourage, their affordances, but that doesn't mean that we have to take the next step to broadly legislate against them or to ban them or even to campaign against them. We just have to, start at least by encouraging an environment in which people are more ethically engaged and which people see that technologies aren't abstractions, that they are really embedded in specific social and political environments. And sometimes the solution to a technology that might seem out of control might be another technology, it might be a modification to that technology, it might be a law, or it might be something else entirely that we haven't envisioned. But I don't think we can necessarily paint with such a broad brush and say that, well, some should be outlawed right off the bat.
Jacob Silverman, author of the book Terms of Service, Social Media and the Price of Constant Connection. You answered, Jacob, what was going to be my last question, I think, which was, what would you want policymakers to take away from the book? And I think you just answered it, although I'll give you 20 seconds, literally, if you want to texture anything else.
Well, I'll just say I've been pretty encouraged by the FTC hiring some technologists, and last year the Senate had hearings about data brokers. So, you know, I don't really fear regulation. I think a lot of these companies are very rich and successful and can survive under even a more stringent regulatory environment. And so I'd like policymakers to do their job and start getting engaged and see how we can use these ethical impulses of ours to create better policy that really helps everyone.
Jacob, thank you so much for joining us on the show. A terrific book, and I'm very glad you took the time today to chat with my listeners.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Next week, last show for the spring quarter on KZSU's schedule, we're going to be chatting with Jason Ross Arnold, author of the book Secrecy in the Sunshine Era, The Promise and Failures of U.S. Open Government Laws. And then as I do, I will take a hiatus during KZSU's interim, and you can look for new shows to begin airing again in July. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. This quarter, you can listen on Wednesdays, 4 p.m. Pacific time by going to KZSU or by streaming live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, by going to the cyberlaw.stanford.edu webpage for CIS, or by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you can not only get Hearsay Culture, but all of the other wonderful events going on at CIS. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com or by going to the contact form at hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.